everybody, and welcome to the Deadhead Cannabis Show. Jim Marty, reporting from Denver, Colorado, where our weather is actually too nice. We have forest fires. So, Larry, how are things up in Chicago?
Jim, always great to hear from you. Things in Chicago are kind of overcast, a little rainy the last couple of days. No forest fires here. Of course, we don't really have a lot of forests to begin with. And not to make light of the subject, because I've been watching the news and it's really kind of scary what's going on out there. Are you within reasonable proximity of any of these fires?
We are on Saturday just very close to the fires in the foothills behind Boulder. The town behind us, closer to the west, got evacuated. We didn't get evacuated. The danger is the embers float 3 miles in the air, and then they get sucked into your attic, and that's how your house catches on fire 3 miles from the fire.
Oh, my God. I didn't realize that the danger zone was that large.
Yeah, we're going to put some screens on our attic vents.
Makes sense. Wow. Okay. Well, good luck with all of that.
We're saying 26 structures just west of Boulder have gone up.
Have any, to the best of your knowledge, have any cannabis businesses been affected? Grows or anything like that?
Don't know about that. There's some retail very close to where I live, and they're okay.
Well, you know, the scary part is I was just reading an article the other day about how they're saying that the entire California 2020 wine crop is ruined, even for the wineries that didn't burn down, because all of the heavy smoke in the air has a chemical reaction to the skin of the grape, and it affects the taste of the grape. So most of them are saying we can't have a 2020 vintage because the grapes have all been negatively affected. I haven't heard anything similar about marijuana, so I can't really speak to that, but certainly with all the fires that have been happening both in California and Colorado, even for those grows that haven't been directly affected by the flames, I'm wondering if we might not still see some impact as a result of all the smoke.
I've heard that about the wine, that the 2020 crop in California is going to be almost non-existent, so you might see prices uptick. So stock up on wine, because I think you'll see price increases.
And, sure.
I think there was something in the news about California treating cannabis similar to wine.
Actually, you're absolutely right. Only in California, they've just come out with a new bill that establishes regional identifications for cannabis products and basically creating appellations, which is, you know, a page right out of the wine industry's playbook. But the significance is that they said that cannabis was found to be like wine, a quote, product of the place, close quote, due to the factors like microclimate, soil, geology, you know, that those are the factors that determine what strains of cannabis will grow well there. So in the wine industry, and now in the cannabis industry, appellations by, you know, saying grown in Napa Valley or grown in, you know, the Triangle or wherever you want to say it's grown, depending on the product, they're used to establish reputations for quality and distinct characteristics of products from specific regions and to educate consumers about unique qualities that are there because of the fact that these strains were grown in particular places. Huh. I think it's very interesting. I think it kind of, you know, I like it because once again, it's normalizing cannabis if we're going to, you know, give it the same type of factoring that we give for wine. But I don't know about you, Jim, but I see this as a tremendous solution to the branding problem, right? Mm-hmm. You can't get a trademark for marijuana names or products, but if you can put something on your label that says grown in Humboldt County and only you can put that on your label, you know, I think that goes a long way in this industry.
Very interesting that, you know, it must be grown outdoors.
Yes, right. That was interesting because I read that the growers out there were trying to get the same protection for indoor grows. And the group that's in charge of this said no, because if it's grown indoors, it's irrelevant where you're growing it.
Interesting.
So, yep. So it's only available for outdoor grows.
Interesting. Yeah, growing outdoors, you can get, you know, obviously very large volume, very large weight. But the issue is not what you spray on your cannabis, it's what your neighbors are spraying on their alfalfa or their corn
that right.
contaminate your outdoor grow. So, yeah, here in Colorado, some of our outdoor grow clients are tucked in between hills and things like that, that protect them from contaminants on the prevailing winds. So yeah, growing outside is a much less controlled environment than growing in a greenhouse or a warehouse.
But what I really like about it is, you know, for years, at least in my circle of friends, and I'm assuming yours too, and this seems to be a pretty universal sentiment, right? You talk about, oh, stuff that was grown outdoors in Hawaii or stuff that was grown outdoors in the California coast, you know, up near the triangle, and how wonderful it is, you know, and all of a sudden people start showing up and say, yeah, this was grown in California, the triangle. Well, does it have a label on there that says so, right? And, you know, I suppose it could become a little snobbish, like the whole champagne or sparkling wine debate. But nevertheless, you know, if you know that you're getting a Blue Dream that was grown outdoors in California, that might mean something to you as a consumer, and you should have the benefit of knowing that.
Yep. So, what else we got? It's kind of quiet. We're a week or two ahead of the election, and so we'll talk more about the results. There's five or six states voting on medical or adult use, so we'll
right.
Back around to that.
And next week, actually, Jim, I think for our listeners, our show next week will be coming out on the Monday before Election Day. And so listeners who are interested in hearing about marijuana proposals that are on ballots, in case you live in a state that has one, we will be going down a list of all of those. So if you want to tune into that show, you'll be able to find out where these votes are taking place.
Yes. For our listeners, there's a company that puts out a monthly report, and a month or two ago, they did a pretty deep dive into all the ballot initiatives that are on the ballot around the country this fall. And the name of that outfit that I work with is Higher Yields. So if you Google Higher Yields, you can find that report. And Larry and I will go through that report a week from today.
Yep, absolutely. Because if you, in case you're not otherwise motivated to go out and vote, let that be the reason to motivate you to go out and vote. So whatever it takes, but you know, if you can support a good cannabis proposal, we want you to do it.
Yep. Yeah. This is a very nonpartisan show. We have one issue that we really care about, and that's the proper legal framework and regulatory model for cannabis. Other than that, we just encourage people to get out there and vote, exercise your right as an American to express your opinion.
Absolutely.
As Jerry Garcia, I believe, said, not voting is voting.
And leave it to Jerry to find a way to describe the ability, you know, doing nothing is doing something. But yeah, look, you know, whatever. I just think it's important because everybody has an opinion. If you stop somebody on the street, they'll certainly give you their opinion. If you have an opinion, go vote. You know, it's one way or the other. So at least we know that whatever the results are, it's the results of what the people in the country really want. And again, if you're looking for reasons to motivate you to go vote, if you're tired of politics, go vote for the cannabis initiatives. You know, find out what's happening in your community on a local level. There's always something to go vote for.
Yes. Okay. Other things to talk about, I guess, Missouri.
Yeah. So Missouri. The state of my birth. I grew up in Missouri, still remain a diehard St. Louis Cardinal fan, and was just in St. Louis last week visiting my father. And lo and behold, my visit coincided with the opening of the first medical cannabis dispensary in Missouri. It's called Bliss, B-L-I-S-S. It's located in St. Louis County, which is rather large. It's the entire metropolitan area surrounding St. Louis City. But again, not very far from where my father lives. And I was able to drive by and, you know, like you would expect at any new opening of a dispensary, especially the very first one in the state, there were long lines. There was news media. There were people protesting it. There were people in favor of it. But this is big news in a place like Missouri, Jim. You have to understand, Missouri politically has always been a very, very conservative state. And these types of ideas, while, you know, you and I certainly agree, I think that people on both sides of the aisle enjoy this product, and that's not always the factor. But sometimes certain politicians will be receptive to their constituents. And Missouri also has a large population of evangelicals who are also not big supporters of any type of intoxicant, whether it's alcohol or marijuana, which I learned when I went to the University of Missouri Law School and met a number of kids from the state who were that way. And it was very interesting that people would be like that, but it is what it is. But here comes Missouri, and they're going to have marijuana that you can go out and buy, at least for now, if you're a patient. And it's tremendously exciting for me to see. They're predicting huge numbers, and they're going to staff it, if you will. They're going to have close to 100, almost 200, 192 dispensaries and 60 cultivators. Illinois, by contrast, had 21 or 22 cultivators and 55 or 56 dispensaries. And our population, you know, maybe close to double Missouri almost.
Right. Isn't Missouri about 6 million?
Something in that range. Yeah, they're very close in size, I think, to Colorado.
Right. And sometimes it's referred to as the buckle of the Bible Belt.
Yes, it is. That's it. Absolutely right. The buckle of the Bible Belt. If you ever go down to Branson, that's where it all takes place. So yeah, and another thing for Missouri that bodes well is, here we go. The first dispensary is just opening. They already have 65,000 registered patients, with an estimated 10,000 more being processed. Whereas in Illinois, at our peak, before adult use came along and people were incentivized to join, financially incentivized to join the medical program, we only had about 40 or 45,000 people in the program. So, you know, when Missouri's predicting $250 million of sales next year and over $650 million by 2024, there's no reason to think that they won't get there.
Oh, yeah.
And I'll tell you, Jim, very rare do we, you know, not so rare, but it's always fun. We get this nice little connection that comes together where our two topics fit right in with each other here, and those being cannabis and the Grateful Dead. And when I started law school at the University of Missouri in 1984, I wasn't really sure what to expect down there. I was coming out of Ann Arbor, Michigan, which was very liberal at the time. In fact, they had decriminalized marijuana long before. So possession of an ounce or less in Ann Arbor was a $5 citation, and people would wear pins saying $5 is fine with me. It's superimposed over a cannabis leaf and all that kind of stuff. But when you get down to Columbia, Missouri, it's a whole different world down there. I was ultimately able to meet people in Columbia who were able to direct me to the right people to be able to take care of my cannabis needs. But in so doing, I began to hear stories of a strain of Missouri weed called Missouri skunk weed. And it was no more descriptive than that. I'm sure nobody could even tell you if it was a indica or a sativa or anything like that. But the rumor was that it was a favorite strain of the band members and staff of roadies of the Grateful Dead. So much so that they would go out of their way to schedule shows in Missouri, in Kansas City and St. Louis, to give them an excuse to drive through the state and go through Columbia and stop and make their purchases. And in fact, from the, I would say about 1968 through 1972, the Grateful Dead played a huge number of shows in St. Louis and, you know, some at Washington University, some at the Fox Theater, which only held a couple of thousand people, some at one at a community college nearby, one at SIU, Edwardsville, just across the river. Common to all of those was it got them into Missouri and presumably within range of this Missouri skunkweed. So maybe this really is a rebirth of the Missouri cannabis movement, and we'll find out.
Well, we'll see. Yeah, a lot of things are, you know, happening in Missouri. The fact that they're already having harvests and retail sales in October, when really those licenses were just issued at the end of 2019, the beginning of 2020.
Yeah, they've moved quickly.
They've really,
and that's
well,
even in the face of all that.
Yeah, some operators obviously got first to market, so good for them.
Yep.
To hear it. I think they'll hit their numbers. It is medical only, but Missourians, is that the right term?
Yep.
Missourians have a lot of health issues. There's a lot of diabetes. There's a lot of obesity. They eat a lot of fried food. So even though it's a medical only program, it'll still, I think, produce very good sales. And I think, isn't Missouri one of the states that's on the ballot for November for adult use?
Not yet. Not yet, but they will be there soon. I think they're going to have a year or two of medical just to prove to people that, you know, it's not, doesn't spell the end of the world. And by the way, if you're going to talk about fried foods in Missouri, please don't leave out toasted ravioli.
Very good. All right. Well, that's sort of the political landscape, less than 2 weeks from, as they say on the news, the most important election of our lifetimes.
Well, and along those lines, Jim, and talking about the voting, one other, you know, quick little story that I just want to throw in here before we switch over to music. You have to be at least our age or maybe just a few years younger than us to remember the name Marvin Washington, who was a defensive end with the New York Jets from, I think, 1989 to 1995. He may have been an all-pro one or 2 years, a very good player for a team that always was a high-publicity team. And when Marvin retired, somewhere along the way over the last 20 to 25 years, he has turned towards cannabis, as have a number of former NFL and NHL players and Athletes for Care and other actions like that, organizations like that. And in fact, at a number of cannabis conferences that we used to go to, including some of the Cannabis World Congresses, founded and run by our producer, Dan Humiston, it was not uncommon to see groups of former athletes coming in to do presentations on the benefits of cannabis. But Marvin was always very, very outspoken on the issue, and it was hard to miss Marvin. He's the size of a small house. I'm about 6'1", and I'm used to being one of the taller guys in the room. But boy, I felt like a little kid standing next to him. At any rate, a few years ago, Marvin was the lead plaintiff in a lawsuit that was filed trying to get a federal court to declare that the government's classification of marijuana as a Schedule I controlled substance is unconstitutional. And over the years, I've heard a number of arguments made about that, both on a legal and a factual scientific basis, why it's a random and arbitrary and capricious classification that doesn't merit staying where it is. As one would have expected, the district court dismissed the lawsuit, I believe, on a standing issue. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which should have been an automatic affirmation of the district court, actually gave Marvin a choice and told him that instead of ruling on the appeal, they would give him an opportunity, his group an opportunity, to reach out directly to the DEA and ask for a voluntary reclassification from Schedule I to Schedule II. Marvin said no to that because a reclassification from 1 to 2 doesn't really do very much for people. We still have 280E, we still have the bank rules, we still have a lot of stuff. And I think the goal was, you know, let's just take it off altogether. So when his group turned down that offer, the Second District went ahead and affirmed the trial court. The matter was taken up to the Supreme Court, and just the other day, the Supreme Court entered its order denying Marvin and his group's writ of certiorari, which is the legal process by how you ask the Supreme Court to hear your case. There was no opinion published, so it's unclear exactly why they chose not to take the case. I'm guessing it's because they probably see this as more of a legislative issue, and that if the legislature wants to change the classification, then it should go ahead and do so. But either way, for anybody who knew about the case or has ever heard of Marvin Washington, this was just another attempt, as you and I have been talking about, Jim, to find ways, at least people looking to find ways, to legalize marijuana. And of course, as you and I always do say, on the one hand, there's a lot of benefits to that. But on the other hand, if you're in this business and you have a vested financial interest in this business, there is a lot of benefit to considering not being necessarily legal at this time.
Well, yes. And as we've discussed, certainly, we prefer a legislative fix than a Supreme Court decision. We have a very conservative Supreme Court right now, right, with a majority, soon to get an additional conservative seat. And their position, I believe, is that their job is not to legislate. Their right. job is to interpret whether the laws Congress passes are constitutional.
Right. I agree. That's what they've said.
And I'm fine with that. I don't necessarily sure. want an activist Supreme Court circumventing a legislature. But that's very interesting. The legislation we are behind, or I certainly behind, is called the States Act by Cory Gardner. Colorado was in a very tough fight with former Governor Hickenlooper to keep his Senate seat. And also the other co-sponsor is Elizabeth Warren on the Democratic side, who I don't think is up for re-election.
I don't think she is either.
So thinking that's enough politics.
Absolutely.
Talk some music.
FOD. Yes. So, yeah, you know, the beauty of this is the Dead haven't played in ages, but there's always just so much to talk about that, you know, when we sat down today to think about what to do, you come up with three or four topics before we can blink an eye. But what I really want to start with, and we've talked, we mentioned this maybe very briefly last week, Dave's Picks is about to come out with its next volume. The last one that came out was great because it was from a show that I had seen in Philadelphia in 1984. And now this next one that's coming out is going to be a show from Hartford in 1987. And for me, this is just a time to celebrate. I'm a 1980s dead guy. That's when I got on the bus. That's when I started watching them, you know, and even though it went into the 90s, I still, my roots lay in the Dead and their sound of the 1980s. And for too long, there have been no releases or very, very few releases from the 1980s. I think in Dick Lavatla's 36 volumes for Dick's Picks, there was only one show from the 1980s. And now Dave has put out two back to back, but it's just great to see. It's a great sound. You know, Brent at his strongest and really going well. Jerry coming back from his first diabetic coma and really picking up where he left off, you know. And Hartford was just a magical place for shows. Unfortunately, I never saw them there. But I know from accounts of others and from having reviewed set lists and listening to bootlegs that was always a favorite place for the Dead to play. And so it's great that they've released this. I'm looking forward to getting it sometime in the next week or so. And, you know, can only hope that this signals a real direction to focus on shows throughout the 1980s for a while.
Yes, me too. as I think I mentioned, my first show was 79, but I saw many shows in Colorado in the 1980s. Night runs at Red Rocks, Telluride 87, McNichols shows several years later on between Thanksgiving and Christmas. So yes, we had lots of great Grateful Dead shows in the 80s in Colorado, where again, that was my run too, up into the 1990s in Las Vegas at the Silver Bowl. In fact, as I've told on previous shows, my last Grateful Dead was May of 1995 at the Silver Bowl in Las Vegas. So I think we had a little bit of to have about FOD, Friend of the Devil.
Well, that was something else that I wanted to throw out there. And, you know, I guess this just goes in the category of do your homework, but go to the shows. For years, Jerry Garcia plays Friend of the Devil. The Dead sing it. I sing right along with it. It's my song. I love it. It's one of my all-time favorites. I can sing it in my sleep. I have friends who used to sing it to their children, but instead of saying Friend of the Devil, they'd say Friend of the Doggy so the kids wouldn't get scared. You know, and all sorts of little fun things like that. But what I started noticing was sometime in the last 10 years, when the song would be played by Phil and Friends or by Bobby or Dead and Company or by other people, there was a verse that got added on at the end that I had never heard before. And just really quickly, it goes, you can borrow from the devil. You can borrow from a friend. The devil will give you 20 when your friend got only 10. And it's the last verse of the song. And I couldn't figure out for the life of me where that verse came from, who had invented it, why it was part of the song, why they were singing it. Jerry had never sung it. So I just assumed that meant it was what it was. And I was listening to the Grateful Dead Hour, or the Grateful Dead show on Sirius XM on the Grateful Dead station last Sunday. And somebody called in and happened to ask that question. And they gave an answer that really knocked me over, which is, that's a lyric that's original Robert Hunter lyric, was part of the song originally. And sure enough, when I went and I pulled out, you know, Robert Hunter's Box of Rain or whatever, his lyrics book, there it was right there, right along with all the other verses. I had never even occurred to me to just go pick up the book and look and see if it was there. I was so certain that it couldn't have been a part of the tune. And so I started digging deeper. And apparently Robert Hunter says that when he wrote the song, he wrote it in stages. And by the time he got to this last verse, Jerry had already recorded a version of the song without it. And apparently Jerry was just not willing to change his mind or his musical interpretation of the song to include that verse. So he never sang it. I don't know so much that it was a protest as much as just he felt it would upset the balance of the song the way that he had it in mind when he wrote the music. And so it was just all eliminated. And now here it is being brought back, you know, and certainly part of Hunter's work and very much deserving to be out there in the open. And, you know, for me, it's just an important lesson, you know, that you can love Jerry, but you just better be careful. You know, if you buy in with him all the way, there might be some hidden secret that you just don't know about. So, you know, kudos to Robert Hunter and to the rest of the band for finally giving him his due for that last verse.
Well, a couple of comments on that is, now, is FOD, that's what us deadheads call it, Friend of the Devil, FOD. Is that off of Working Man's or American Beauty?
American Beauty.
Okay. So at the time, the band was under a lot of pressure from Warner Brothers to keep their songs to 3 minutes so they could have FM radio play and right. AM radio play back in the right. 70s. So yep. That might have been one of the reasons to leave off that last verse. My other comment is, though, you can hear Robert Hunter pretty much when he played Friend of the Devil, he would include that last verse. And there's a lot of live recordings of Robert Hunter singing Friend of the Devil that include that last verse.
Well, I have to confess that somehow that was something that had always escaped my attention. I've heard Robert Hunter sing many times, and maybe I had just never focused on it. But, you know, I'm satisfied. I've now come to the end of my quest. I understand what it is, and I'm all for it.
All right. Now, coming to the end of our time slot here, I guess we can end on maybe a bit of a sad note. You had a friend who had a heart attack. You want to tell that story?
Yeah, this is it's both a sad story, but with a dead, favorable dead twist for an ending. I have a very dear cousin, a first cousin, who is an attorney here in Chicago. Love her dearly. She's a few years younger than I am, so I didn't spend as much time with her back in the growing up days. And now she's gone and far exceeded me in the legal circles. And so, you know, I'm the one looking up to her. And she married a wonderful, wonderful man who was an attorney in her law firm with her. And they're both in their early 50s, and they're both, triathletes for their honeymoon when they got married. It was the second marriage for both of them. So only a few years ago, they went to run a triathlete, which I couldn't understand, but they were happy as can be. And he was a big deadhead, the husband. And the husband had a good friend from his college days or wherever who somehow has a connection to Phil Lesh. And Phil Lesh had even come to Chicago to play a birthday party show in this guy's backyard a year before that my cousin and her husband had attended but couldn't tell me about because it was a big secret, so they wouldn't draw huge crowds that weren't invited. But after my cousin's husband passed away, the friend reached out to Phil Lesh and, you know, said, look, this guy passed away. It was very tragic. He was a big fan of yours and the band. And, you know, if you can help out one way or another, it would really mean a lot. And Phil, to his credit, sat down with his group and they put together about a 45, well, it was just about exactly 45 minute set of music that they prepared from, you know, remote locations and, you know, brought all together in one of these, you know, big puzzle piece Google screens. And a memorial service, online memorial service was planned for my cousin's husband. And we all logged on, and within a minute or two after they made their introductions, they started this video. There was Phil Lesh giving a shout out to Feisty, which was his nickname. And the next thing you knew, they were playing Eyes of the World, Into Help on the Way, Slipknot, Into the Wheel, and back into Slipknot. When unfortunately the time ran out before they could jump into what everyone had anticipated would be a great Franklin's. But it was just a wonderful, wonderful feel good moment. Not the least of which because, you know, Phil Lesh is a busy guy. He and his group don't have to take time out to do this kind of thing. But clearly they did. For me, that's just, you know, another check mark in the plus column for Phil Lesh, who's already, you know, one of my all-time favorites.
Sure. And I can tell you, I'm a big Phil fan. Really enjoyed seeing him post Grateful Dead at Red Rocks, et cetera. Who was in the band with him, do you know?
No, I'm assuming that it was what they refer to as the family band.
The Terrapin family band, right?
Exactly. That plays up at his Terrapin Crossroads location, which I believe includes two of his sons. There was a female vocalist who I don't know her name because she had a wonderful voice and she was really, really good. The drummer was great. He was sitting in his apartment drumming on whatever objects were in front of him. He didn't have a kit. He had his desk and a stapler and something else. And he was just, you know, playing off of that. And it was great. You know, I think one or two of them were actually standing on the deck of the Terrapin Crossroads, place out in Marin County. But it was wonderful thing to see, and it made everybody feel good for a little while, in relation to this guy. And for my cousin, it was a wonderful shot in the arm for her. And, you know, you hear all sorts of stories about rock and roll performers, and some are more temperamental than others. But, you know, you always like to think that the guys in the Dead would be, you know, a cut above the rest and would have that little special spark in them. And, you know, this is certainly a plus for me in terms of, you know, my overall feelings of Phil Lesh. So it was a great thing to see.
Yes. Very good. Yes. I've been to Terrapin Crossroads. It's on a little sandy spit into the bay, and it's surrounded on three sides by water. It's a very beautiful place. We're coming to the end of our time slot, but we can probably squeeze in one more story about Trey Anastasio recently playing, and I guess he's doing it most Friday nights for the next few weeks at the Beacon in the north side of Manhattan.
Yep, he's doing a residency up there at the Beacon Theater, which is just a talk about, you know, there's certain rock and roll venues in the world that just, you know, all you have to do is just say their name and people know what you're talking about. And the Beacon is definitely one of them. And even though it was already a famous venue, there's no doubt that the string of residencies that the Allman Brothers did there every March for probably about 10 years running just elevated it to the next level. And, you know, Trey, yeah, he's playing there every Friday night for 7 or 8 weeks in a row with his little residency. It's all being broadcast so people can hear it. He sounds great. He's got great energy. He plays a whole wide variety of stuff. And you heard something interesting about that show, Jim. What did you hear about?
Well, one, I've heard some of it on Fish Radio, on XM Sirius. And sounds great. A lot of new songs. The old songs sound really good. Doing some very interesting a cappella. And Trey at a microphone with no guitar. So it's very interesting things coming out of that. Mm-hmm. Trey, to help the people who work at the Beacon, is paying them basically to listen to his show. So all the people who would normally be working bars, selling beers, cleaning up the venue at the end of the night, are being invited to get paid to come to listen to him play. And then I guess on the economics of it, they make it up with the live broadcasts on XM or where he's posting his live music to. I guess that's how he makes up for the economics of paying all these people to come to the show.
And he gets an audience.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
Yes, probably some social distancing.
Yeah, it's okay.
It's a beautiful old theater. I went to a New Year's show a number of years ago with my son for a government mule show. We actually went to Manhattan without tickets, and we couldn't get tickets to MSG from Fish, but we did get tickets at the Beacon for a government mule.
Nice.
I've been to that. It's a beautiful old theater.
Yep.
And, another Beacon show is David Byrne has a new documentary that's just fabulous music.
Oh, you know what? I'm so glad you mentioned that, and we really should have talked about that. Let's put that on the burner for next week because that's something that has to be addressed.
Yeah, that's a very interesting. I believe Spike Lee directed it.
He did. It was that. Yes. Thank you for mentioning that. It was just on HBO the other night. And I think it's going to be shown on HBO, you know, over the course of the next month or so. I can't even remember the name of it as I'm sitting here. But if anybody was a David Byrne fan or a Talking Heads fan, or even if you don't know who David Byrne is, you need to watch this. It's just tremendous. And we will definitely talk about this next week.
Looking forward to it. He's really a national treasure. His voice sounds just the same as when he was in Talking Heads.
Isn't it amazing?
We looked up his age. He is 68 years old.
Yep. Yep. And he was up there moving around and having a good old time. It's a fantastic.
All right, everybody. I'm going to say over and out from the Deadhead Cannabis Show. Larry, say goodbye.
Goodbye, everyone. Thanks for listening. As always, stay safe, stay healthy, and enjoy your cannabis responsibly.
Over and out.